we are in the fourth dwelling place, and this is where your prayer begins to take on a supernatural character. And Father was talking about something at Mass this morning that I thought was really very interesting. He was talking about the difference between the pre-resurrection Jesus and the post-resurrection Jesus, and what the difference is. And I was thinking about, well, who is Teresa relating to in these prayers? The pre-resurrection Jesus or the post-resurrection Jesus? Because in the pre-resurrection Jesus, his humanity is dominant and his divinity is kind of hidden. And so people are always asking, are you the one? You know, are you the Messiah? Mm-hmm. Are you? And he never gives them a straight answer. He wants them to figure it out and then use faith to figure it out. But the post-resurrection Jesus, his divinity is now dominant and his humanity is kind of hidden. So he walks through walls, you know, goes into the upper room and, you know, does all kind of stuff, you know. People see him but don't recognize him because he's hidden. Like on the road to Emmaus, they recognize him in the breaking of the bread. And so his divinity becomes prominent and his humanity is hidden after the resurrection. So it's interesting there. So I started thinking about that. And, you know, who is Teresa relating to? And it seems that she's relating to the post-resurrection Jesus more so than, although she does talk about, you know, his humanity. And loving his humanity and all. But when she's talking about that union, that almost has to be the post-resurrection Jesus. But I thought it was interesting. I'd never had heard anybody talk about the difference between the pre-resurrection Jesus and the post-resurrection Jesus, you know?
I think we always think of them as one.
Well, we always, you know, it's a hypostatic union. And so we don't really think of them as separate. But I just thought it was interesting.
One is more predominant.
One is more predominant before and after. Yeah. You know?
What did Father mean when he said on the cross that Jesus said, why have you forsaken me? You know, I know it's the psalm, the one psalm.
Right.
But he said it was something else, too.
Today he said that?
Yeah.
Yeah, this
I don't
morning
remember.
He talked about it.
And I was like,
he mentioned.
What?
Was he stressing the humanity of Christ? That Christ, we have to be associated.
Oh, it's pre-resurrection Jesus.
Yeah, so Christ felt abandoned on the cross.
Yeah, he was talking about
feel that.
About the humanity.
He
felt the passion. Yeah, the he was talking about the sweat, you know, the sweating tears, the blood, and everything else.
Okay.
And there's a doctor that wrote a book on the passion, and he said that that you can actually sweat blood under certain physical circumstances, under great stress, it was one. And you wonder, well, what was the stress that he was under that was so great that it made him sweat blood?
He saw all our sins.
And it was the, he could see what he was going to have to suffer for our sins. But I think it was also because he knew that that suffering was temporary. You know, by the next day, it'd be all over. But the thing that really got him was he was going through all this and people would still turn their back on him and reject him.
The souls that are lost.
The souls that would be lost who would refuse to accept the offer of himself. You know, it's...
And he
had
also,
to be hard.
According to Sister Emmerich, I think. I don't know if she was a sister.
Yeah.
He also saw all of the people of the church that would turn their back on them.
Yeah.
The priests and the bishops.
Yeah. Right.
And so,
well, don't they say there are a lot of priests in hell?
Some
of the mystics say.
What does St. John Chrysostom say?
Yeah.
He said the road to hell is paved with the skulls of priests and bishops.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you can kind of see it right now.
So we see a lot of them that their pride gets in the way and they start trying to, you know, change the church to satisfy their needs. And we see that some of that
today,
happening right today, you know?
Right in our face.
Yeah, right now, right now, you know? So.
Yeah.
Well, that's why Blessed Mother asks us for prayers big time.
That's right.
For the priests.
Yeah. That's right.
We were talking about yesterday at the Carmelite meeting. That's one of the goals, well, union with God with the Carmelites.
Right.
But pray for priests. That's why we're doing the book now.
Sure.
We do it at the Carmelite.
Yeah, Blessed Mother, she keeps asking that in her apparitions.
Yes.
Pray for the
pray
Pope, pray for the bishops, you know?
And the church.
Yeah.
And Ignatius of Antioch one of his letters as he was going to Rome to get martyred. Mm. He said, always obey your bishop. And back then, the bishops were really good. A lot of them were disciples of the apostles.
So they were people held to a higher standard. The more you know, the more is expected of you.
Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
worse if you know what's right and
right.
you choose the other
yeah.
than somebody who didn't have all that formation.
That's right.
Didn't have all
yeah.
those advantages. So I think, yeah. you know, it's easy for us to judge or whatever, but I think it's more the fact that they've been given such a gift of
yeah.
formation.
That's right.
And the mentoring yeah. that
they
goes
have,
through
yeah.
with it, you know, to them
yeah.
before they can become priests.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because back then they would just go into a town and then kind of make somebody a priest, you know. They didn't go through 5 years of formation and, mm-hmm. and everything, training
Maybe
and all.
The family paid for it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And Alan has now joined us from the Philippines. Hi, Alan. And so that's
but
a good
you know,
thing.
Christ also said, I will be with the church. So I keep thinking he's got to throw these people out of the church. Do you know if he is with the, I will be with you all.
But days. he doesn't want to throw them out. He wants them to convert and repent.
Yeah.
He wants all the souls
yeah.
to
yeah.
join him. And he wants every soul to be with him in heaven.
Right, but you okay. think of Christ as being with the church until they, well, then the church must hold the truth, but then you've got
yeah.
all these
yeah.
other things.
So the yeah. so the mystical body of Christ is the church, and so he has to heal it as the great physician. Mm-hmm. And so how is he going to heal that, you
right.
know? Sometimes you heal by surgery, and you cut mm-hmm. something out and throw it away, right?
Mm-hmm.
But other times, you just give it medication and heal it.
Yeah,
it's like purifying.
Yeah,
he's purifying the church right now.
Right.
I feel like we're in the passion.
Yeah,
the church is
yeah.
in the passion.
Right.
Yeah,
we have
and then
to have
God
this.
Is going to triumph. We all know God is going to triumph in the
right.
end. That's not a question.
Right.
That is
right.
not a question.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
and
right.
Blessed Mother says her Immaculate Heart will
yeah.
triumph
yeah.
in the end.
Yeah, yeah. John Paul II taught us that the church, just like Christ, would have to go through his passion, but then it would resurrect to be more mm. glorious than ever. Mm. And I just hope we're around to see that, you know?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
that'd be really nice.
There was
yeah.
something, I don't know if it was on the Catholic Register or New Advent, about Pope Benedict had said that this gender philosophy, did you see that?
No, I didn't. Mm.
He said that it was, of course, of the devil. It was the last, you know, scourge of the church.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I hope so. But
yeah.
you know, you see the, some of the stuff about the bishops and how they're, why now they're reinterpreting some things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there a door open that they can finally say, well, I want, this is how we think some things should be defined, and we've been wrong all these years? And
yeah.
I know we haven't, but you
right.
know what I mean? How can they?
Well, they want to remake the church in their own image.
I'm like, mm. why don't they just go and become another faith that allows it?
That's what.
Why are they trying to take down
yeah.
the church?
Because they
it?
Well, because they're an authority in the church. They go to somewhere else, they're not going to be an authority.
I guess.
So
yeah.
they won't have all the status and, you know, trappings and everything else that they have now.
And then they can't do damage to the church because they'll be out of the church in their own church.
Right.
And our church, which is rid of them, will still go on. So they didn't accomplish what they
yeah.
wanted to do.
I just
yeah.
don't understand their motivation sometimes, because it's like, well, why would you...
It's pride.
Is there people telling you, I want, yeah. you know, you need to be doing... You know, I don't understand.
A lot of it is pride. I want my way.
Yeah.
I don't want to follow what Christ said. I want to do it my way.
Well, you got to think of all the education they got and all the...
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
that you suddenly say, no, what we learned all those years was wrong.
That could be the devil.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Temptation. That's what it is. He's
That's
doing
it. Is.
He's putting it in their head.
I was talking to the guy who runs CMJ
amazing.
Publications. It's a Catholic publication office publisher right outside of Chicago. And he was telling me one day that Father Hardin wrote a book on the Eucharist. And so he sent it to the Bishop of Chicago, which back then was Bernardin. And he wanted to get an imprimatur. And Bernardin said, I'm not going to give the imprimatur. The real presence isn't true.
What?
And he was the Bishop of Chicago, you know? So But the interesting thing is that when you see something like that going on, a lot of the men who want to enter the seminary would see that, and if they were good, you know, they would apply to a different diocese to enter the priesthood. Mm-hmm. And Father Guest, who's one of our priests, was from Chicago, but he applied to Arlington because he knew we were a conservative, you know, diocese, and we're faithful to the teachings of the church and all. And so he applied here instead of in Chicago. You see that. And a lot of times when you have a situation like that, when that bishop leaves, dies, or whatever, the church will put a good one in his place, which happened there. You know, the next guy that came in was really good and very faithful. Mm. And so let's go on. And we are in... at 4171, this section 7, the first chapter of the fourth dwelling place. And so Teresa, in this particular section, brings out one of her most predominant sayings that she says it all the time of other places. She says, "I only wish to inform you that in order to profit by this path and ascend to the dwelling places we desire, the important thing is not to think much, but to love much. And so do that which best stirs you to love." So it's one of her favorite sayings. Mm-hmm. She then defines love because she thinks that many do not understand what love is. She thinks many people think love is an emotion. And so how does she define love?
To please God.
Yeah. She says, "I will say nothing about..." Because I've spoken at length on this subject elsewhere, so I will say nothing about it here. "I only wish to inform you that in order to profit by this path and ascend, the important thing is not to think much, but to love much. And so do that which best stirs you to love." And then she says, perhaps we don't know what love is. So she's kind of assuming that a lot of people don't know what love is. And so she said, "I wouldn't be very surprised, because it doesn't consist... in great delight, but in desiring with strong determination to please God in everything, in striving insofar as possible not to offend Him, and in asking Him for the advancement of the honor and glory of His Son and the increase of the Catholic Church." Why would she include that last phrase, the increase of the Catholic Church?
Because that is what Christ desires.
What was going on? What was going on during her time?
The Inquisition. Yeah.
Was it the Inquisition? Was it? Or the,
well, it was also the Protestant Reformation.
Oh, the Reformation.
So she was. She talks elsewhere about what a terrible thing that was to reject the church that Christ started, and so a lot of what she talked about and taught and all was to try to counter what was going on there. Hmm. And so that's why she includes that here in this phrase as part of her definition of love. So these are the signs of love. Don't think the matter lies in thinking of nothing else, because she knows you're always going to be thinking about a lot of things. Mm. And so I got some eye. And that if you become a little distracted, all is lost. She said, don't worry about that. But just so obedience to God is a big thing with her. Obedience to the commandments, obedience to the teaching. She'll mention that several times as we go through this book. And so she's very, very strong on obedience to God. And so to please God in everything, try not to offend Him. And so try not to offend Him is another way of saying try to avoid sin. Because the one thing that offends God is sin.
Ten Commandments.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the Ten Commandments and then the commandments that Christ gave us. You know, the two great commandments, love God and love your neighbor. Those kind of things. And that's important for her because she'll tell us in Dwelling Place 5 that the only way we really know we love God is by how much we love our neighbor. And so we'll see that later on as we continue. And for the advancement of the honor and glory of Jesus, of his son. And so she's talking about the Son of God here. So she's talking more about the divine Christ than the human Christ here. The honor and glory of his son and the increase of the Catholic Church. So those are the things that... and then we also recall that love is an act of the will. Mm. It's not just an emotion. And so when she's talking about doing this, she's really saying you have to make a conscious act of the will to do this. It's not something that's just like a passing thing. It's a conscious act on your part to do these things that she's talking about. So you make an effort to find out what the commands of God are, and then you make an act of the will, see, I'm not going to break these commandments. And I'm not going to offend God, and I do that by avoiding the near occasions of sin and by trying to avoid all sin, including venial sin. And so those are the two ways we respond to what she's saying here.
It's my phone. Potential spam.
That's okay.
The what?
I didn't know if she could hear it.
Oh.
It says spam.
Oh.
Shut up. I don't care.
Okay. And so we go to paragraph 8. It says, Teresa speaks about the difference between the mind and the intellect. And for her, the mind usually means the imagination, as opposed to the intellect. There are two faculties of the soul, of the intellect and the will. And so she sees a difference between the soul acting and our worldly imagination acting. Mm. Even though we can use the imagination to do good things and pray and stuff like this. Mm. It says, for many years, Teresa was troubled by a distracted mind, which interfered with her prayer. And she's talking about meditative prayer here. She was told by her confessors and all that, and by her superiors that, oh, you have to spend time in meditative prayer. And it was almost impossible for her. She was going crazy. And one of the things she used as a way to get around that was spiritual reading. Instead of praying, she would bring a book and do spiritual reading. And those books helped her a lot in her reformation of the Carmelite Order, because she picked up a lot of good ideas from the reading. She read Ignatius Loyola's Spiritual Exercises and his formation of the Jesuits, what he went through, Peter of Alcantara, who's a Franciscan. So she knew these people. They were contemporaries of hers. She read their writings, and then she incorporated a lot of their ideas in her reformation of the Carmelites. And so when somebody tells you that you know, if you're going to be a Carmelite or a Jesuit or something, you can't look at anything else, just look at Jesuit stuff. Teresa did that. You know, she incorporated a lot of things when she reformed the Carmelites. And so that was a good thing for her. So I think God probably was giving her this trouble, because he wanted her to go through these other things. And so even though she was being told, you have to do all those discursive meditation, and she was going crazy trying to do it and couldn't, she found the solution that helped her, and that was in spiritual reading. Mm. That kind of prayer was impossible for her, since she thought it was what she was supposed to do. It gave her a lot of consternation. She was trying to be obedient to her superiors and to her confessors, you know, and she had a lot of struggle with that. It took her a long time to kind of get around that, get through that. Father Cavanaugh, in his notes, points out that for 18 years, Teresa suffered from the belief that she must practice discursive meditation and reflection in her prayer. So think of that. 18 years she was being hindered in her growth because she was trying to be obedient. And God would say, no, you're not going to do this. I'm not going to let you do this. I want you to do something else. Yeah. And in the book of her life, in chapter 4, she says, with this recourse, which was like a partner, what saved her were the books that she used for her prayer. In her life, she says, with this recourse, which was like a partner or a shield by which to sustain the blows of my many thoughts, I went about consoled. one of our favorite books was The Sinner's Guide, which we can still get today. And it's a pretty good little book. It's nice. So here she comes to a doctrinal conclusion when she says this. So she has things incorporated into this book that are actually expressions of doctrine. And there aren't too many people that actually incorporate that right into their writings, you know, but she does. And I think that was partly because of the time she was in and what she was trying to deal with the rejection of doctrine by the Reformation. So she was trying to bolster the doctrine. Here she comes to a doctrinal conclusion when she says, ordinarily the mind flies about quickly, for only God can hold it fast in such a way as to make it seem that we are somehow loosed from this body. I have seen, I think, that the faculties of my soul were occupied and recollected in God, while my mind, on the other hand, was distracted. This distraction puzzled me. Father Kavanaugh's footnote says that here she has come to a definite doctrinal position on the matter. The instability and rebellion of the imagination is a consequence of the disorder produced in us through original sin. And so that distraction was an effect of original sin, but she got through that by the way she was able to recollect herself in God and letting her mind go kablooey, you know, go all over the place. And so that recollection, letting her soul be recollected as an act of the will and the intellect while her mind was flitting all over the place, was something she finally was able to do.
So she's thinking of one thing, but her soul is with God?
Yeah.
And then how does she know that she's thinking of... How does she know she's thinking of something else, but yet she's with... I get confused by that.
Well, you know, you can do that sometimes when you're praying. You'll be praying and thinking about what you're praying about, even though your mind is like having some conversation somewhere else, and it gets all distracted. But you, most of the spiritual experts say, don't pay attention to that, what your mind is doing. When you realize it's happening, you say, Jesus, excuse me, I have to come back to you, and you try to just come back to what your soul is focusing on. Because the devil's always going to try to distract you from prayer. The last thing he wants you to do is pray.
I laugh some when I'm taking a shower in the morning, because I always say the morning offering, and never fails. I mean, there is always something. I'll get through it, and then this big distraction will come. It's okay, Lord, we're going to do it again. And then maybe I do it three times.
I know. It takes me half an hour at least to do one straight one thing of the rosary, because I said, okay, I got distracted, I'm going to do it again. And it's like an act of the will to do it again. And I just say, take those extra Hail Marys.
Exactly. And not to get worried over it. You know, just go back and do it.
You know?
That's it.
Like, did I do it?
Yeah, it's so,
you know, because you're driving.
So I can so identify with what she's saying.
Yeah. And my friends tell me when you reach an age, because they're all around my age, they'll be doing the Chaplet of Mercy or something, and on their fingers they'll go, what decade am I on? And I do the same thing, even with the rosary sometimes. You know, I'll go back and say, did I say the third? Or sometimes I mix it up, and I'll put the fourth meditation on the third one. We just mix it up a little.
Just mix them.
You know, Mother Teresa would always do like an extra for a thank you. And I always do an extra because I'm like, I think I missed one there. There's another one, a couple few more going in there.
So it's a common human condition. Yeah. And like Father Kavanaugh says, it's the result of our disorder produced by original sin. And so, you know, original sin acting in you is not something that you overtly do unless you're thinking about it and then give your consent to it. If it's something that you're not giving consent to, then you don't worry about it. It's like a temptation. You know, temptations are not sinful. It's only when you give in to the temptation that it can be sinful. And so it's the same kind of a thing. So when you find yourself doing this, and you realize it, you say, sorry, Jesus, bring me back, you know. and you come back to do it. Because the one thing that will drive Satan away all the time is the name of Jesus.
Or Mary.
You know? It's, yeah, let Mary, yeah. So do you think a distracted mind can interfere with your progress through the dwelling places?
Guess it's all about your focus.
Yeah.
What?
Yes, it's all about your focus if you allow yourself to be distracted.
Yeah.
And you might be inclined to give up and say, what the heck, right. You know, I'm not progressing.
Maybe it's your attitude.
Attitude.
Yeah. Towards
focus
it.
Focus and attitude. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like she's changed, like she's come to accept this and work with it rather than stress over it. Like sometimes we tend to stress over it.
Right.
And that's not what, is what keeps us.
Oh, well, you get into it too.
Yeah.
So the extent of to which a distracted mind can interfere with your growth is driven by how much you give into it.
Act of will.
Yeah. How much you actually give into it. Mm. And so if you reject it and you do an act of the will and go back to Jesus and say, it's like when you have a temptation, the best thing you can do the minute you realize it's happening is to call on Jesus and ask him for help. So get this temptation away from me, you know, whatever it is. Mm. And but the more you indulge it, the worse it gets. So when you realize your mind is distracted, you say, oh, this is fun. I think I'll stay distracted for a while. Mm. That can interfere with your growth. Mm-hmm. But if you realize you're being distracted and then you go to Jesus for help and say, get me back on track here, you know, it's not going to really interfere with your progress.
You have something where you're thinking about it half the day and then you feel like, then you realize halfway through the day, I spent half the day mulling over this issue. And you're like, that's when you're like, oh no, bring it back in. But
well, you try to do it as soon as you realize it's happening.
No,
you
know?
And, well, that's when you say you give it to Jesus, you say you take care of it.
You didn't get any farther with it. You're just mulling it around. And like,
Right. A lot of times I'll say now in my head, stop. I'll just say stop. Mm-hmm. You know, when these things come in. I have to, that's my act
you
of the will.
You take an act,
to say stop. You know, like I'm speaking to
Get out of here.
You know what I mean? And then I call on the name, you know, say, Jesus, help me, you know, with this.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then in paragraph 9, she's talking about these people who are distracted. So she laments over those who are plagued with a distracted mind and do not understand the difference between the mind and the intellect. She says, terrible trials are suffered because we don't understand ourselves. Some even abandon prayer altogether. They get so frustrated with distraction, they just say, I can't pray. I'm just going to give it up, you know. You never want to give up prayer. Mm-hmm. Some even abandon prayer altogether. We should not be disturbed, nor should we abandon prayer, which is what the devil wants us to do. For the most part, all the trials and disturbance come from our not understanding ourselves. So this understanding of ourselves here is understanding the difference between the intellect, the mind and the intellect. Your distracted mind, your imagination is going to take you all over the place. You're flitting around from, like a butterfly going from flower to flower. But your intellect and your will can keep you grounded. And that's the real difference there. So when Teresa speaks about these disturbances and trials coming from distractions, because we do not understand ourselves, and she's speaking about the same thing as the self-knowledge she spoke of earlier. You think that self-knowledge plays a part in this?
I saw it on both sides, which can't be, you can't have two answers the same. My original thought was no. You have to understand the working, as she says, between the mind and the intellect.
So it seems different.
So it seemed different to me.
Yeah.
Because this self-knowledge is more our traits, personality traits. Mm-hmm. And this is more what we have to work with.
Because before she was talking about self-knowledge as understanding where you are in this journey.
Yeah.
You know, she keeps saying, go to the two rooms of humility and self-knowledge, right?
Yeah.
So your self-knowledge is taking an honest look at your growth in your prayer, and then seeing, are you progressing or not? And then the humility comes into play there too, you know? How much like Christ am I trying to become? Because he says, imitate me. So I'm trying to imitate him. And so you look at yourself and you say, you know, I'm really far away from him because he's perfect, right? But am I getting closer? Am I getting to be more like him in the way I deal with other people, in the way how much I love my neighbor, and this kind of thing? And the self-knowledge comes in to the, you know, so am I actually progressing or am I kidding myself? That kind of thing. But I think this...
It's different.
This is different.
Yeah.
This is understanding that when you are praying, when you do have a distracted mind, don't let that interfere with your actual prayer. Because your prayer doesn't have to be words. And that's another thing that you have to realize. Because it doesn't have to be, you know, Our Father, Hail Mary, and Glory Be, and all that kind of stuff. It can be just thinking about God, thinking about the attributes of God, thinking about how much you love God. And
yesterday we had the Carmelite meeting. We have to do half an hour. We go into the chapel in Bristow, and we have to do half an hour of silent prayer. Well, the meeting before that, I'm telling you, the evil one was all around me. I go in, and I had to make this big, thick book. I dread it. But this lady wanted to be a teacher with me. And you go along with things. She made the vow, and I'm not going to cause problems. So anyway, there's only one teacher in my class, which is me, but all the others have two. They said, oh, you don't need one. I was happy doing one. I didn't have to make phone calls and everything. So anyway, I made this big, thick book for her. Okay, that's done. So, I mean, pride enters into everything. So I went to the meeting, and I happened to sit at her table. I didn't realize it. I should have known. So anyway, I handed her the book. I mean, it's an example. And it was just... Well, not that I'm looking for everything, but maybe. I mean, this is... I say, thank you. I mean, it took me. But the main thing was I wanted to explain to her what was in the book, because it's how we run the meeting. And there's like this page and that page and attendance and this and that. Well, she... I don't want to criticize, but I'm just telling the story. She made the vow, so... I only made the promise. I was telling someone who made the vow about my meeting. So that was that. But my stomach was turning. I was not a happy camper. But God had me at that seat next to her. And I said, well, just, you know, threw it out.
So you'd be nice to her, right?
So anyway, so after that, we go into the meeting. And the room is so tiny. I mean, I get claustrophobia. We had six. I'm the seventh. And two more came. Two newcomers. It's like where? And I got the book on my lap. I have to hand out things. Sometimes you drop them. It's like the lady sitting next to me is a newcomer. And we were doing the lesson. And she goes, I know all this. I don't even know this lady. She just came in. She says, this is ridiculous for me. Why am I here? I said, well...
Why are you here? Go home.
I said, have you been in the Carmelites a long time? She says, a couple of months. But I know everything. I'm like, oh, my God. I can't even say that I'm a Carmelite 20 years, right? I mean, So anyway, she was very upset, though. And I said, I'm going to say a few words, but it's not criticism. It's just coming to me. And please don't take it as criticism. But I said, you can know everything in the world as a Carmelite. You can have read every book. You know the Constitution by heart. You know the statutes. I said, doesn't make us holy Carmelites. I said, it's an attitude. Union with God, make your life a prayer, give everything to Jesus. I said, God doesn't care if we don't know the statutes word for word. I said, and you'll only be in this group of 6 more months. I said, other people here have been in it for nearly 10 months. I said, St. John of the Cross said, nada, nada, nada. We give up all this stuff. We don't please us, we please God. I said, I hope maybe some thoughts would help you. She said, yes, but it was like,
What a day. Oh, so my main point, I'm sorry. We went into the chapel for silent prayer. Well, I sat there for half an hour and just said, Jesus. I said, that's it, Lord.
You were in shock. You went in there.
I said, just, that's it. I'm just going to sit in your presence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was. Never had a meeting like that. It was. But I don't take things seriously. I'm just sharing it as an example. I don't get mad at people, you know, but it was, that was the unholy one,
hard.
I bet.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're always going to have somebody that's going to be a thorn in your side. St. Paul had them too, you know? Mm-hmm. And God, that's one of the ways God teaches you how to have patience, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You can't grow in patience without a reason to practice it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
And she's coming to my house in 2 weeks to go, because she wants to do the teaching. But she wants me to get out of the room, and she'll do the teaching 1 month, and I'll do it the next month. But it's not sitting well, because I don't know how she's going to run to me. You know, it's like...
Well, why does she want you not in the room?
Yeah. Well, because I can go to the big room, and that's where there's formation for those who are already professed.
Okay.
But that's not good, because you lose contact with the newcomers.
Yeah.
And and I see that, because we did it once. It's horrible. So I'm just going to be firm.
Yeah, you're just sitting in the back of the room then.
Yeah, it's a small room, right?
Yeah.
How can she throw me out, you know?
Yeah.
That's why, you know, do you think sometimes it'd be funny. Nice to be a hermit?
Yeah. I've often thought that.
Little all by yourself?
Yeah. Okay. 11, section 11. Teresa speaks of pain she has in her head when the faculties of the soul are not suspended in prayer, but the pain is not felt when suspension does accompany the prayer. The suspension she speaks of is what she will discuss in the fifth dwelling places. You kind of almost go out of yourself. It's almost like an out-of-body experience, you know. But she had a lot of physical pain for a long time, and when you have that kind of pain, it can interfere with your prayer, because it forces your mind to be conscious of it, and it's a distraction in itself.
It's physical pain. She has like an ailment that would, you know, like a medical thing,
right? And so she would have these physical pains. Father Kavanaugh's notes talk about, you know, the pain and everything she had to deal with, and but that is another form of distraction. So in addition to the imagination, you're also distracted by this pain. Mm-hmm. You're trying to pray, and all of a sudden, you get this massive headache. But then when she was able to go into the higher form of prayer, all that pain went away. It's almost like she left her body and was able to commune directly with God, which she did in some cases. Mm-hmm. She was in the sixth dwelling places, she would talk about actually the flights of the spirit, she calls them, which is what we saw St. John do in the book of Revelation. You know, he says, I was taken up in the spirit into heaven, and I saw the Father and Jesus and all that kind of stuff. That kind of thing. So she had some of that kind of experience too. But she would begin her prayer session oftentimes with a great deal of pain. And she suffered from migraine headaches, from what Father Kavanaugh was talking about. And so it's...
Yeah, she sounds like she has what I have, that tinnitus.
Join
the crowd.
Yeah. She says, it isn't good for us to be disturbed by our thoughts, nor should we be concerned. If the devil causes them, they will cease with this suspension. If they come, as they do, from one of the many miseries inherited through the sin of Adam, which is what her headaches were, let us be patient and endure them for the love of God, since we are likewise subject to eating and sleeping without being able to avoid it, which is quite a trial. So do you think if we ignore the disturbances or of thought that come from the devil, he will go away and leave us alone?
Try something else.
Yeah, he's never going to leave you alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one thing he's going to always try to do is keep you from praying. So he'll afflict you with anything he can to get you to stop praying. That's the one thing he doesn't want you to ever do. He would try to give you imaginative delights that you can think, oh, what a wonderful thing it'd be to do this, and whatever. And he wants you to, you know, think about everything else except prayer. He doesn't want you to pray. Because when you're praying, you're in union with God, communion with God. And that's the last thing he wants you to do. And as you begin to progress, his ability to do that diminishes the further you are. So he's still able to get to affect you, but not very easily at this point, because now God is beginning to take over. Your prayer is becoming more supernatural, and so he has much less effect on you than he would otherwise have.
And I would think that he would see that kind of as his last chance, so he would increase.
He would try harder, but he's not able to do as much. He was able to do a lot more in the first dwelling place than he can here. He'll try hard, but because of the asking of God in your prayer becoming more supernatural, he can't really do that much unless you submit your will to him and let him take over. So just ignoring disturbances are not going to help. You have to just reject them and just tell them to go away. Say, okay, I see what you're doing. Get out of here. Jesus, send him away. Ask your guardian angel to help you. Throw him away. Ask the Blessed Mother to come. Ask her to keep you under her mantle all the time. Because he won't touch you when you're under her mantle. That's the end of chapter 1. So we begin chapter 2. In this chapter, Teresa is explaining the nature of spiritual delights. We kind of touched on those last time a little bit. And so she'll talk more about what they are in this chapter. And how we cannot attain this by seeking it. It's a gratuitous gift of God over which we have no control. So remember, we talked about consolations and spiritual delights, where consolations originate in us, but spiritual delights originate in God. So just out of the blue, he'll give you some of these spiritual delights. And we don't have any control over it, and we can't make them happen. They originate in God, and he decides if and when he wants to do it. He won't necessarily do it. You know, you might get all upset and say, gee, I've gotten, I think, about this far, and he hasn't given me any spiritual delights. But you don't worry about that. Because Teresa also says you don't need any of this stuff to progress. You can progress all the way without any of it. I've often thought that, you know, if you get a lot of them, maybe you need them. And maybe if you don't get any, you're doing well enough that you don't need them. You know, but anyway, these spiritual delights are something that God originates. They originated in him, but you definitely feel them. You know you've received them. So in the first few paragraphs, I kind of summarized what she's talking about here, 2 through 4. Teresa says that what she calls spiritual delights, she has elsewhere called the prayer of quiet. The prayer of quiet is a term used very often by writers of her time to refer to contemplative prayer. She says these spiritual delights are very different from consolations. She uses a very interesting image of two kinds of sources of refreshing water to explain them. One, referring to consolations, is a source resulting from our discursive meditation efforts. And she compares it to building aqueducts and troughs and everything else to bring the water to your soul. The other spiritual delights are like a source which springs up through no effort of our own and never goes dry. It's like you're thirsty and all of a sudden the water's there. And I think it's interesting that she talks about the water here, because Jesus often talked about water all through the scriptures. You know, you look at the Exodus when Moses hit the rock and they gave him water, and St. Paul says that that rock followed them through the desert and continued to provide water for them. And then Jesus, in the Gospel of John, about the woman at the well, says, you know, if he asks me, I will give you living water. So he's always talking about this water thing. And so she brings up that same idea. She goes, what does water do? It refreshes you, but it also keeps you alive. Mm-hmm. They say we can go without food for several days, but we can't go without water for more than like 3 days. I mean, if we do that, then we begin to have some very serious effects. And so this idea of water is very important. And so she uses this imagery. The spiritual delights are like having a well that's right in front of you. It's no effort. You just dip a cup in and drink it. The source of this water, it overflows from a large stream. The source of this water is God. We recall Jesus speaking of life-giving water in his conversation with the woman at the well. We also recall from Exodus that God gave his chosen people water from a rock. I think we just talked about that. I thought I had put it in here. St. Paul, in his letters, says that this rock was a manifestation of Jesus and followed them on the journey through the desert. He also gave us water together with his blood from his side on the cross. And so we have that prayer that we got from the divine mercy, O blood and water which gushed forth from the heart of Jesus. That's a conversion prayer. And so we see this imagery of water being a spiritual good coming in a number of different places. The water God gives here, the spiritual delights, refresh the soul and draw us closer to God. They're a form of prayer, since Teresa says prayer is a relationship with God. So prayer doesn't mean you've got to be talking. It doesn't mean you've got to be saying anything. Anytime there's a communication with God, whether it originates in him or originates with you, that's prayer. Spiritual delights are a supernatural form of prayer which are given with peace and quiet and sweetness from the innermost part of our soul, because that's where God is. These waters spring up from the center and permeate the entire castle. The delight we experience is felt in the soul, not the heart. It permeates everything until it reaches the body, which is the outer wall of the castle. It begins in God and ends in ourselves. So the body is the outer wall of the castle. Everything inside of the castle is our soul.
I never heard that. And how many times we've read that book, this book at the Carmelites, and no one ever said that, that the outer wall is the body.
That's a direct quote from Teresa here. So do you think this imagery of springs of water is a good one to describe this kind of supernatural prayer? And why do you think so? And can you think of some other imagery that is equally effective or even better for describing this kind of prayer? I'm not saying there is, I'm just asking the question.
Do you think imagery of springs of water is a good one?
I don't know if this is better, but I think of like incense, you know, and when they in church, when you know, when they send up the prayers, you know, and incense tends to permeate, you know, everything too.
Yeah.
And even if you're 50 feet away, you can smell it.
Yeah.
You know.
Now this might sound crazy, but to me, the bird, well, I always see birds, it's like reminds me of the Holy Spirit. And the smaller the bird, they can fly so high. And I always think it's like our prayers ascend to heaven. You know, it's like our little prayers go all the way up to the throne of God. It's like, well,
yeah.
But
the angels carry our prayers up to God, you know.
But the water is really better, I think, imagery, because, you know, it cleanses.
Yeah.
It nourishes.
Yeah.
You know, it
refreshes, like you said.
Yeah. Just like not an object. Yeah.
Which the incense smoke doesn't do.
Right.
It's deeper.
No,
it's different.
Yeah. You see, the big difference to me between those things is that if you look at the birds or the incense or anything like that, it's our prayer that we're offering to God going up to God. So it originates with us. Okay?
Yeah.
This water originates with God.
Yeah.
And it's a free gift that He gives us to refresh and cleanse our soul. And get us more and more prepared for that ultimate union with Him that we get to in the sixth and seventh mansions.
Mm-hmm. And it's like God doing the work in us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's it. So she calls these spiritual delights something that originates in God. So it's God initiating it. He's doing it to us.
Yeah.
He's doing it with us.
Yeah.
And it's for our spiritual growth. So every time you have an experience like this, it's God saying, okay, I want you to grow a little more. You know, you're 5 years old now. I want you to be 6 years old. I want you, you're 40 pounds now. I want you to be 60 pounds. I want you to grow. And that goes right in with what she said before about the capacity of the soul. She said, never think that the soul has a fixed capacity. It can always keep growing. And the thing that gives the soul capacity to grow is love. And the more love we share, the more capacity for love we have, and the more our soul grows. And that's why if you look at the three theological virtues, faith, hope, and love, the only one that survives to go to heaven is love, because we don't need the other two at that point.
I always think of the imagery of, you know, when you're in Mass and your guardian angel, they say it's lining up with a bowl with all your prayers.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, what do our prayers look like in that bowl? Is it going to just go up? Is it like feathers or is it...
Well, I think
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're supposed to say all the things that you want.
Yeah, and it's fine. And what I've always been told, and I try to do it, is that whenever you pray, you ask your guardian angel to perfect your prayer.
Mm.
Or ask Jesus to perfect your prayer and then bring it up. Because our prayer, because of our fallen nature, is never perfect. Right?
There is a prayer, if I can remember. Oh, my Jesus, I place before myself the precious blood of Jesus so that my prayers will be purified before they ascend to the altar above.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're asking God to perfect your prayer.
Yeah.
Because and if you look at the prayers of St. Bridget, the 12 years prayers of St. Bridget, in the very beginning of that prayer, the preamble prayer, it talks about how you want to say our Father, but you're asking Jesus to perfect that prayer as you say it so that it brings as much joy to the Trinity as you gave it here on earth.
Mm.
And so when you're in that prayer, you're asking Jesus, first of all, to pray with you, but also not just to pray with you, but to perfect your prayer so that it has that effect when it goes up to the Father.
I heard there's a little CD that we had at one time under Mary's mantle, and it was one story, and it was about children praying the rosary and how they were so distracted or, you know, they didn't do the greatest job. And then later on, I don't know, the imagery they got was that they gave rotting fruit, and then Mary made it look better to give it to Jesus, and then they felt terrible because they gave this bad fruit, and it was stuff like that.
Yeah, and that I think that's something that people don't do enough of. They don't. We know when they pray, it's all them. They're praying, and I'm gonna send you this prayer, give you this prayer at all, but you never ask your angel or Jesus or Blessed Mother to receive your prayer and perfect it and then give it to God.
Mm.
And I think that's something we should all get in the habit of doing, you know, because our prayer is never that perfect because of our fallen nature, but they're perfect. And so we can ask them to perfect our prayer.
And I think I heard a priest once say, like when we say, in the name of the Father and of the Son, of the Holy Spirit, we're praying like in union with them or with they're with us or something.
Yeah.
That we don't do it alone.
Right.
Like it's the prayer of Jesus.
Right.
When we pray to God. That's why we make the sign of the cross with something like that. Mm-hmm. Mm.
So always ask, you know, your angel, Jesus, to perfect your prayer and then present it to the Father.
Well, y'all made me feel lazy because you're saying extra ones because you think you might have forgotten one. I always end with that. Say, please perfect it. Because I know, like sometimes I said 11, sometimes I said 7. Yeah, I usually pray when I'm walking. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of hard to
I always go, I go, did I do that last decade?
I
Let's
know.
Do it again. 20 minutes later, oh man, this is taking a while.
That's why I always use a rosary when I pray, because if I didn't, I'd never know what decade I was on.
You know, like with the Chaplet of Mercy, like if I have to do it, if Tom's not there, I don't hear too well. So I got to wait a few minutes to be sure the last person is done, because many times, Anne, on the other side, I think once in a while we throw another one in once, you know. And it,
Well, I have a CD, and sometimes I'm driving, and I'm like, I went through that whole CD, and I don't even remember it. And I'm saying it with it, you know?
Yeah. Okay, it's 10:30, so we'll stop here. We'll pick up 4-2-2-4-2. Is that what we just did?
No, we haven't done that.
No.
Okay.
Yeah,
we'll do 4-2-2-4-2 next time.
Yes.
Yeah. Right in the middle of the page. Okay, thank you everybody for coming. Oh, anybody have anything you want to bring up before we quit for the day?
Next Monday, Memorial Day?
Oh, that
really Oh, yeah. So you better take off next Monday.
Okay.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Okay.
Okay, sounds
great.
Have
a nice weekend. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Have a blessed
Yeah, we're going to be on a
Memorial Day.
Mary Beth and I are going on that Dice of Columbus retreat next weekend.
Oh, great.
At San Damiano.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's going to be nice. We went last year and really enjoyed it.
I heard it was really good.
It was really good. Yeah.
It's good to go on those, yeah.
Father
I just put
Riley
in the mail
going
to
be given
to go,
a retreat there in
to Europe.
Oh, okay.
Ooh,
nice.
He's good. With Father Guest.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, it's in the fall. Yeah. We'll see.
Okay. See you next week.
Okay. Have fun.
Okay.
Did you see the paper? There's a St. Pius the 10th thing being built. I think it's in Winchester direction. You know the St. Pius that's the 10th, which is...
Yeah.
Did you see where they were building?
No.
Well, they've gone before the whatever town it is, and it's somewhere, Winchester, Front Royal, back up that way, and they've gone for a building permit, I guess.
No.
And the town, wherever it is, they're questioning their... the way in and the way out. But anyway, I thought, why haven't we heard about